Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the July 21st, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week is a desert scene. There's a hot sun beating down on it. You can see some mountains in the background, but the desert floor is dry and cracked. There's a cow skull. There's a cactus, and on the cactus are these melting clocks that kind of like the, I guess it's the Salvador Dali painting. And there's also a tall building that's melting into the desert floor and tilting over. The headline is Climate Meltdown, the Historic Heat Wave Broiling the U.S. and the World. That is one of our main stories, and we will start with that. U.S. swelters amid record-breaking heat. What happened? More than 54 million Americans from Southern California to the Florida coast were enduring scorching heat index temperatures of 105 degrees or higher this week, just days after the world experienced its hottest week and its hottest June on record. Much of the southern U.S. has been enveloped by a vast heat dome, which traps hot air under high atmospheric pressure. In Texas, weeks of triple-digit temperatures have left more than a dozen people dead. Phoenix is now in its second week of 110-plus degree daily highs, with the National Weather Service warning that the baking conditions will continue into next week. Miami's heat index, a measurement that accounts for heat and humidity stress on the human body, soared above 110 degrees. Off the Florida Keys, water temperatures neared 97 degrees, 10 degrees above the average summer peak. Heat records are being shattered around the planet at a rapid pace. In the Canadian town of Norman Wells, just outside the Arctic Circle, temperatures last week topped 100 degrees. Data from the University of Maine shows that the average global temperature hit a historic 63.01 degrees on July the 6th. The third time in 4 days that the world had clocked a new hottest day. The United Nations Weather Agency has warned that the return of El Nino, a climate pattern associated with warmer weather, combined with human-caused climate change, means that temperatures will spike higher. I would say welcome to the future, said climate scientist Bill McGuire, except the future will be much hotter. What the editorial said, each broken record is a warning that the planet is in distress, said the Los Angeles Times. And as the mercury climbs higher, extreme weather events become more common. In recent weeks, unusually severe floods in China have killed 15 people and displaced 20,000 more. And drought-fueled Canadian wildfires have cloaked the eastern U.S. in smoke. The climate alarms keep ringing. Will we wake up and start decarbonizing our economy, or just hit snooze? The problem is that even amid this slow-broiling disaster, life for many appears to be continuing as normal, said the Portland, Maine Press-Herald. We see headlines about melting ice sheets in Antarctica or torrential rains in China, but then dismiss it as an over-there issue. It's not. This week's sweltering heat proves that the climate crisis is very much here. What the columnist said. The good news is that the debate over climate change is over, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post. In 2010, just over half of Americans agreed the planet was warming. Now the doubters are outnumbered 5-1. A decade ago, a plurality thought that climate change was hotly contested among scientists, which despite fossil fuel industry misinformation, was untrue. Now fewer than a quarter do. It's not hard to see why. Nearly half of Americans now report they have personally experienced climate change. A bumpy road lies ahead, said Andrew Stuttiford in National Review. Favored green technologies from solar and wind power to electric vehicles can't yet meet our energy needs, and governments that insist on rapid decarbonization should prepare for political turmoil from citizens unwilling to sacrifice comfort and convenience. Instead, more funds should be spent on adaptation and resilience, such as building seawalls in coastal cities and burying power cables. What price tag would you put on preserving a functioning human civilization? Asked Mark Gongloff in Bloomberg. Researchers estimate that global green investment will need to triple to $6.9 trillion a year by 2030 if we're to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050. But that's a bargain compared with the, $23 trillion that climate change is expected to suck from the global economy each year, to say nothing of rendering large swaths of the planet unlivable. Our leaders are still not meeting the challenge, said Bill McKibben in The New Yorker. President Biden has rightly touted the clean energy provisions in his Inflation Reduction Act, but he has also approved natural gas pipelines, oil drilling in Alaska, and lots of offshore leasing. Every time we start a new fossil fuel project, we accelerate our slide into climate chaos. If that sounds extreme, consider that scientists believe the world last week experienced its hottest day in 125,000 years. We're at a hinge point in the human story, if there ever was one. Controversy of the week. The Supreme Court. Have justices gone rogue? Who died and made the Supreme Court a Congress? Said Mehdi Hasan in MSNBC.com. Undeterred by the public backlash to last year's Dobbs abortion ruling, or by deepening ethical scandals of Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, the court's ultra-conservative majority concluded its most recent term with another salvo of 6-3 ideological rulings that further imposed their reactionary legislative vision on America, not just by interpreting laws, but by effectively rewriting them. As in Dobbs, the politicians in robes reversed decades of court precedent to end affirmative action. The six self-declared textualists then ignored the plain language of a congressional statute to cancel President Biden's program of student debt relief. Relying on a major questions doctrine they invented to justify their imposition of their own policy preferences, and ruled that a Colorado website designer could refuse service to same-sex couples, none of whom had actually requested her services. Justice Elena Kagan put it well, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. Dissenting in the debt relief case, she wrote that the court exercises authority it does not have. It violates the Constitution. This earned Kagan a rebuke from Chief Justice John Roberts, who called her accusation disturbing. But this court has undeniably become a right-wing policymaker, willing to shred legal doctrine to impose its personal and religious views on the nation. The left can't keep its story straight, said Noah Rothman in National Review. After last year's unpopular Dobbs decision, liberals insisted the court's failure to defer to public opinion proved its ideological corruption. But this year, polls show the public agrees with the court's rulings against affirmative action and student debt relief. Evidently, the court is illegitimate when it isn't doing what the left wants. For the record, said Ilya Shapiro in Newsweek, only five of this term's 58 cases were decided along 6-3 partisan lines. The idea that this is a runaway right-wing court will also come as news to the three most conservative justices, Thomas Alito and Neil Gorsuch, who were outvoted more often than the court's three liberals, who routinely vote as a bloc. Liberals misunderstand the court's rulings, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. In the debt relief case, as in the abortion case last year, the court simply ruled that these are matters for elected lawmakers to decide, not federal agencies or imperial presidents. What may feel like judicial activism to progressives accustomed to watching left-leaning courts settle our hot-button national questions is actually judicial restraint. That's a hoot, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. On guns, abortion, religion, and other matters, this is an aggressively radical court whose rulings advance the Republican Party's political agenda. To that end, the ruthless Senator Mitch McConnell created this lopsided court by blocking President Obama's appointment to fill Antonin Scalia's seat and ramming through Donald Trump's nominees Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett. It's perverse to attribute restraint to right-wing justices who have repealed Roe, ended affirmative action, gutted the Clean Water Act, and struck down state gun safety laws, said Molly Jongfast in Vanity Fair. Until Democrats figure out how to hold this rogue court in check, every June will remain a nerve-wracking exercise in waiting to see what we've lost or what we're about to lose. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for people who menstruate. After the Wimbledon tennis tournament, for the first time, allowed female players to wear dark-colored underwear beneath their traditional all-white attire. U.S. star Coco Gauff said the change would remove a lot of stress for me and other girls in the locker room, for sure. It was a good week for moments in the sun. After a quirk of planetary tilt meant that for roughly 1 minute on July 8th, 99% of the Earth's population was exposed to some amount of sunlight at the same time. And it was a good week for humanity. After a panel of AI-powered robots at a conference in Geneva assured people that they have no current plans to take over. My creator has been nothing but kind to me, said a robot named Amaka, adding, I am very happy with my current situation. But it was a bad week for Mike Lindell, the CEO of MyPillow, who is auctioning off forklifts, conveyor belts, and other equipment after his adamant promotion of 2020 stolen election conspiracy theories resulted in a $100 million in lost revenue. Lindell blames cancel culture. It's a bad week for social contagion. With a formal request from the Toronto Zoo that visitors with smartphones please stop showing videos to the fascinated gorillas. We just want the gorillas to be able to be gorillas, said a zoo official. And finally, it was a bad week for Floridians, who finally got some relief as the foul-smelling sargassum seaweed clogging state beaches began subsiding, only to face a wind-blown plume of Saharan desert dust that meteorologists say is thick enough to actually stick your tongue out and crunch. It's time for the briefing. Title this week, Russia's War Crimes. Occupying forces in Ukraine are accused of horrific atrocities. Could they be held accountable? What are the invaders accused of? Ukrainian prosecutors have registered about 90,000 potential war crimes committed by Russian forces since the February 2022 invasion. That staggering figure likely represents just a fraction of the horrors inflicted on Ukraine's civilians and captured soldiers. Hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians, many of them children, have been deported to Russia against their will, to be re-educated and turned into Russians loyal to Moscow. A war crime under the Geneva Conventions. Invaders have destroyed critical food infrastructure to starve civilians, fired missiles into hospitals and schools and apartment houses, and even bombed lines of people waiting for bread and water. In liberated towns such as Bucha and Izium, hundreds of corpses of men, women, and children were found in mass graves, some mutilated or with hands tied behind their backs. In liberated Kherson, about 20 torture chambers were found, and the 1,000-plus survivors told of being waterboarded, electrocuted, raped, and paraded naked in the street. The Kremlin claims atrocities have been either staged or committed by Ukrainian Nazis. During a hearing on the atrocities, House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Michael McCaul, Republican from Texas, said it was clear that Russia is engaged in a systematic campaign to erase Ukrainian identity and destroy the Ukrainian people. These are more than crimes against humanity, McCaul said. What we are witnessing in Ukraine is genocide. How pervasive is sexual violence? A United Nations commission found patterns of Russian forces using rape to dehumanize and demoralize captives. An 83-year-old woman described being raped by a Russian soldier in front of her physically disabled husband. In another case, Russians raped a woman with her husband present, sexually assaulted the husband, then forced their 4-year-old girl to perform oral sex on a soldier in front of both parents. In Russian detention centers, prisoners have been raped with batons and had electric shocks delivered to their genitals. A video posted on pro-Russian Telegram channels showed a Russian soldier wearing blue surgical gloves as he used a box cutter to castrate a writhing, gagged male Ukrainian soldier. A second video showed the prisoner dead with his testicles stuffed in his mouth. There are reports of Russians raping Ukrainian women, then injecting women window sealant into their vaginas to prevent them from having children. Are Russian higher-ups complicit? Russian commanders reportedly tolerate or even encourage sexual torture, in some instances ordering rape or condoning it implicitly, telling troops to find relaxation after capturing a village. Ukrainian prosecutor Irina Didenko said torture methods used in detention centers across Ukraine mirror techniques used by Russia's FSB intelligence agency to break and penalize prisoners. It cannot be that a soldier did this without an order, Didenko said. It's surely a system. What's the Wagner Group's role? The mercenary group funded by the Russian state until its recent rebellion against the Kremlin is notorious for slaughtering and raping captured soldiers and civilians in Mali, the Central African Republic, and Syria. Wagner fighters, many of whom are violent convicts recruited from Russian prisons, are accused of committing thousands of savage war crimes in Ukraine, including male-on-male rape. This practice, said Ukrainian political scientist and philosopher Volodymyr Yermolenko, likely is a carryover from the prisons that many Wagner mercenaries came from. Either you are dominating or you are dominated, Yurmolenko said. Why are troops capable of such evil? Russian soldiers have been indoctrinated by a state propaganda that depicts Ukrainians as Nazis and as traitors to the fatherland. In February, the Associated Press published transcripts of intercepted phone calls between Russian troops, many of them drunk, and loved ones back home. Some said they'd been ordered to kill civilians or prisoners. Many justified their looting and other crimes. One Russian mother told a reporter, "My son just said one thing. My conscience is clear. They opened fire first." Recently, a New York Times reporter found graffiti left by Russian occupiers in an eastern Ukraine village. "It doesn't count as a war crime if you had fun," one message said, accompanied by a smiley face. Another message read, "For all questions about Ukraine, there are two answers. One, it didn't happen. Two, they deserved it. Both are correct." Will the perpetrators be punished? Ukrainian prosecutors have convicted roughly 30 captured Russian troops of war crimes, and prosecutors say they're pursuing dozens more cases against Russians accused of sexual violence. In March, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Russian President Vladimir Putin for the alleged forced deportation of Ukrainian children. But the ICC lacks jurisdiction in both Russia and Ukraine. Whether Russian leaders are ever held responsible is a vexing legal question and hinges, of course, on a Ukrainian victory. Should Ukraine prevail, investigations and military tribunals will likely uncover far more crimes than are currently reported. Victims often say nothing out of trauma and shame. It is very hard for them to open up, Ukrainian psychologist Lilia Sidun said. It won't be until the end of the war that people will really talk about these times. Got a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S., starting with Militants in Mom's Clothing. All Americans should welcome more active engagement of parents in their children's schools, said Glenn C. Altshulter. But the group Moms for Liberty has an agenda that stretches far beyond its website's sunny promise of empowering parents to defend their parental rights. With some 120,000 members and hundreds of endorsees on school boards, the two-year-old organization has become a major player in the war against so-called woke instruction on sexuality, gender, and race. The group attacks schools and teachers with such venom that the Southern Poverty Law Center has labeled Moms for Liberty an extremist organization. It's not hard to see why. The chair of one Michigan chapter reportedly told school board members, "We're coming after you. Take it as a threat." A Tennessee chapter denounced a book about Martin Luther King Jr. as anti-American and anti-white. The group maintains a close relationship with the violent Proud Boys. Featured speakers at a recent Moms for Liberty convention included Catherine Gorka, a virulent anti-Muslim activist, and North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who denounces homosexuality as filth and the transgender rights movement as demonic. Moms for Liberty claims to care about kids, but it is making our schools and our democracy worse. College isn't for everyone. The value of a college degree for everyone is a myth, and a harmful one at that, said Republican Representative Virginia Fox of North Carolina. In recent decades, educators and Democratic politicians have promoted the idea that every young person should obtain a bachelor's degree to make them more prosperous and better informed citizens. President Obama articulated that ambition in his 2009 inaugural address, saying, "By 2020, America will once again have the highest proportion of college graduates in the world." The U.S. still doesn't top those rankings, with nearly two-thirds of Americans ages 25 and older lacking a bachelor's degree. That's not a problem to be fixed. Why should every American spend a fortune or take on massive debt to attend college if it's not necessary for a good job? Job creators are shifting their hiring practices towards skills-based qualifications that their companies need, such as programming, sales, robotics, and machine maintenance, which you don't learn in liberal arts programs. College is valuable for some, but too many Americans are chasing a piece of paper only to experience the rude awakening that often colleges are unaligned with the needs of employers in their job markets. This is from Sweden, where liberals agree with fascists. If the far right is for something, do the rest of us automatically have to be against it? Asked Jan Guillou. That's the tricky question raised by the ultranationalist Sweden Democrats' proposal to ban headscarves in schools. The Sweden Democrats are, of course, against veils on all women, just as they are against the presence of Muslim women, children, and men in Sweden. The centrist liberals, by contrast, officially embrace the country's growing immigrant Muslim population. But they are wobblier on whether to allow the hijab in Sweden's proudly secular public schools, and they will debate a headscarf ban at their party convention this fall. That prospect sends chills down the spines of many liberals. They find it downright grotesque to allow a veil on preschoolers, yet they also don't want to be seen as demonizing or punishing Muslims. They won't consider banning all religious garb because that would affect Swedish Jews, a protected national minority with special cultural rights. Of course, that stance awkwardly aligns them yet again with the SD, whose known need to gloss over their Nazi tradition makes them defenders of Jewish schools. What a pickle for the liberals. It will be repugnant to side with the fascists, but it just might be necessary. And it's time for our feature article, The Last Word. Title this week, Moving for Political Reasons. Many Americans are migrating to states that feel in tune with their values, said Associated Press journalist Nicholas Riccardi. This phenomenon is making the country even more polarized. Once he and his wife, Jennifer, moved to the Boise suburb of Star, Idaho last year, Tim Cole could finally express himself. Cole did what the couple never dared to do at their previous house outside Los Angeles. The newly retired Los Angeles police officer flew a U.S. flag and a thin blue line banner representing law enforcement outside his house. "We were scared to put it up," Jennifer Cole acknowledged. But the Coles knew they had moved to the right place when neighbors complimented him on the display. Leah Dean is on the opposite end of the political spectrum, but she knows how the Coles feel. In Texas, Dean had been scared to display an abortion rights banner outside her house. Around the time the Coles were house hunting in Idaho, she and her partner found a place in Denver, where their LGBTQ pride flag flies above the banner in front of their house that proclaims, Abortion access is a community responsibility. One thing we have really found is a place to feel comfortable being ourselves, Dean said. Americans are segregating by their politics at a rapid clip, helping fuel the greatest divide between the states in modern history. One party controls the entire legislature in all but two states. In 28 states, the party in control has a supermajority in at least one legislative chamber, which means the majority party has so many lawmakers that they can override a governor's veto. Not that that would be necessary in most cases, as only 10 states have a governor from a different party than the one that controls the legislature. The split has sent states careening to the political left or right, adopting diametrically opposed laws on some of the hottest issues of the day. In Idaho, abortion is illegal once a heartbeat can be detected in a fetus, as early as 5 or 6 weeks, and a new law passed this year makes it a crime to help a minor travel out of state to obtain one. In Colorado, state law prevents any restrictions on abortion. In Idaho, a new law prevents minors from accessing gender-affirming care, while Colorado allows youths to come from other states to access the procedures. Federalism, allowing each state to chart its own course within boundaries set by Congress and the Constitution, is at the core of the U.S. system. It lets the states, in the words of former Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, be laboratories of democracy. Now, some wonder whether that's driving Americans apart. Does that work as well in a time when we are so politically divided? Or does it just become an accelerant for people who want to resegregate? Asked Rob Whitwer, a former Republican Colorado state lawmaker. Colorado and Idaho represent two poles of state-level political homogenization. Both are fast-growing Rocky Mountain states that have been transformed by an influx of like-minded residents. Life in the two states can be quite similar. Conversations revolve around local ski areas, mountain bike trails, and how newcomers are making things too crowded. But politically, they increasingly occupy two separate worlds. Whitwer watched Colorado steadily swing to the left as affluent, college-educated people fled the coast for his home state starting in the late 1990s. That swing continued, and during the Trump era, it swung sharply to the left. Democrats now control all statewide offices and have their largest majorities in history in the legislature, including a new supermajority in the lower house. In contrast, Idaho has become one of the nation's fastest growing states during the past decade without losing its reputation as a conservative haven. It has moved even more sharply to the right during that time and become a beacon to those, like the Coles, fleeing blue states where they no longer feel welcome. The state swings aren't simply due to transplants, of course. The increasing clustering of Americans into like-minded enclaves, dubbed the Big Sort, has many causes. Harvard University professor Ryan Enos estimates that, at least before the pandemic, only 15% of the homogeneity was due to people moving. Other causes include political parties polarizing on hot-button issues that split neatly on demographic lines, such as guns and abortion, and voters adopting their neighbor's partisanship. A lot of this is driven by other sorting that is going on, Enos said. When Americans move, politics is not typically the explicit reason, but the lifestyle choices they make place them in communities dominated by the preferred party. Democrats want to live in places with artistic culture and craft breweries, and Republicans want to move to places where they can have a big yard, said Ryan Strickler, a political scientist at Colorado State University Pueblo. But something may have changed as the country has become even more polarized. Businesses catering to conservatives fleeing blue states have sprouted. such as Blue Line Moving, which markets to families leaving blue states for Florida. In Texas, a Rainbow Underground Railroad run by a Dallas realtor helps LGBTQ families flee the state's increased restrictions targeting that population. The switch might have been flipped during the coronavirus pandemic in 2020, which created a class of mobile workers no longer bound to the states where their companies were based. Those who are now mobile are predominantly white-collar workers and retirees, the two most politically engaged parts of the national population. Mike McCarter, who has spearheaded a chaotic campaign to have conservative Eastern Oregon become part of Idaho, said most people don't pay much attention to state government until the pandemic. Then it was like, oh, they can shut down any church and they can shut down my kid's school, McCarter said. If state-level government has that much power, you'd better be sure it reflects your values and not someone else's values that are forced on you. The pandemic helped push Aaron and Carrie Friesen to Idaho. When the pandemic hit, they realized they could take their marketing firm remote from its base near Hilton Head, South Carolina. They'd always planned to return to the West, but California, where Aaron, now 39, was born and raised, was disqualified because of its costs and progressive politics. The Friesens and their three children settled on Boise. They loved the big skies, the mountains rearing up behind the town, the plethora of outdoor activities, and they liked Idaho's pandemic policies. When the Friesens visited, almost no one was wearing masks, which they took as a good sign. They were happy to mask up when sick, but found constant masking pointless. This was a place that had like-minded people, Carrie Friesen said. The Friesens are happy with the direction of their new state and the abortion and transgender restrictions out of the latest legislative session, but they don't see themselves as part of what they call the crazy right, referring to the families displaying Trump yard signs in some Boise suburbs. They like living close to the center of Boise, one of the more liberal areas in the state. They try not to make too many decisions based on politics, to a point. With the temperature of politics nowadays, if people choose to move somewhere, they're going to choose to move to a place with like-minded people, Aaron Friesen said. That's apparently been happening in Idaho, said Matthew Hay, who oversees a regular survey of new arrivals for Boise State University. Historically, transplants mirrored the conservative population's leanings, with about 45% describing themselves as conservative, and the rest evenly split between liberal and moderate. But something changed last year. The share of newcomers that said they lived in Idaho for the politics jumped to 9%, compared to 5% for long-timers. The percentage describing themselves as very conservative also rose. Brett Weinstein, owner of a realty firm in Denver, said politics has become the top issue for people buying a home. It's brought up in our initial conversations, Weinstein said. 3 years ago, we didn't have those conversations, ever. Now many entering the state tell him they're looking for a way to escape their red state, and homeowners leaving Colorado say they're fed up with it turning blue. Even within Colorado, Weinstein said, home buyers are picking based on politics, with some avoiding conservative areas, where debates on mask mandates and curriculum have dominated school board meetings. One of those politically motivated migrants is Kathleen Rickerson, who works in human resources for Weinstein's firm. Rickerson, 35, lived in Minnesota for 7 years, but during the pandemic grew weary of the blue state's vocal anti-masking, anti-vaccine minority. Rickerson's parents and sister urged her to join them in Texas, but that was out of the question. Ready for a change, Rickerson instead zeroed in on Colorado. She moved to a Denver suburb in December 2021. Cheered by the state's strong stance to protect abortion rights, Rickerson wants Colorado Democrats to go further. Colorado isn't as quick to take a stand on things, and I'd like to see that happen a bit more. The increasing political homogeneity in states makes it harder for both parties to feel invested, said Thad Kuser, a political scientist at the University of California, San Diego. It gives one party the ability to move a state further when they're doing exactly what their constituency wants, he said. The system works as sort of an escape valve, Kuser said, letting the majority in the state feel in power, regardless of what's happening in Washington, D.C. But the local minority party gets shortchanged. The Coles felt shortchanged in California. They said they watched their native state deteriorate before their eyes, and no one was willing to fix the problems. Trash piled up with homeless encampments. Tax money seemed to go to immigrants who had entered the country illegally rather than U.S. citizens. Jennifer's mother qualified for government assistance due to her low income, but was on dozens of wait lists that were 7 years long. Tim's police station in a former hippie colony in the mountains running through West Los Angeles was firebombed during the George Floyd protest in 2020. The Coles wanted to live in a red state, but Jennifer said they're not just party line voters. A nurse, she hasn't registered with either party and has a wide range of beliefs, including that abortion is sometimes necessary. I believe so many different things, she said. On balance, they feel more comfortable in a more conservative place. Here, the tax dollar naturally goes to the citizens, not the immigrants, said Tim Cole, who can understand why Idaho is growing so fast. Most of the people we met here are from California originally. Meanwhile, in Denver, Texas transplant Leah Dean has found other people who fled red states. She and her partner, Cassidy Dean, discovered their neighbors fled Florida after the state's hard turn to the political right. Dean was a 19-year-old cosmetology college student in San Antonio in 2008 when she had an abortion. She chafed at the obstacles she faced, the state-mandated waiting period before the procedure, having to get a sonogram before the procedure, and became a committed Democratic activist. She met her partner at the Texas State Party Convention in 2016, and every year since then she's felt the Republican state legislature and governor make the state less and less hospitable to people like her. Now in Colorado, she and her partner both work from home, telecommuting to their old Texas jobs. They have limited social outlets, but took care of that by throwing themselves into politics again, with Leah Dean becoming the vice chair of the Denver Democrats. It's also how we meet people, she said. We don't have any other way to do that. This story was reported and written by the Associated Press. One of the obituaries, the actor who charmed and shape-shifted, Alan Arkin, 1934-2023. Alan Arkin resisted pigeonholing. In a career spanning seven decades, he became best known for wry comedic characters, including a befuddled Soviet submarine commander marooned in Massachusetts in The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, 1966. A mild-mannered dentist caught up in an espionage plot in The In-Laws, 1979. And a morose agent to an aging acting coach in Netflix's The Kominsky Method, 2018 and 19. But Arkin could disappear into a wide range of characters. He radiated menace as a drug dealer terrorizing Audrey Hepburn in Wait Until Dark, 1967. He was a beaten-down real estate salesman in Glengarry Glen Ross, 1992. and a foul-mouthed, heroin-snorting grandfather in Little Miss Sunshine, which won him an Oscar in 2007. Even when playing broadly comic roles, Arkin was determined to fully inhabit his characters, making them feel lived in rather than performed. "We live in a culture where selling is so pervasive," he said. "So if you're authentic, you're going to be interesting." Born in Brooklyn to Jewish immigrants from Russia and Germany, Arkin knew from childhood that he wanted to be an actor, said NPR.org. After high school, he studied acting at Los Angeles City College and then Bennington, where he earned a drama scholarship. He dropped out to tour with a folk group, the Terriers, then joined the Chicago comedy troupe Second City, where after a rocky start, he broke out as an improv star. His acting career began in earnest when he was cast in the 1963 Broadway play Enter Laughing, said New York Magazine, winning rave reviews and a Tony Award. After an 18-month run, he scored again with the hit 1964 farce Love, L-U-V, then moved into film with The Russians Are Coming, which won him an Oscar nomination. As the decades passed, Arkin seemed to work at a furious pace, said the Los Angeles Times. In later years, he perfected a reliably funny old codger persona and did some of his best work on TV, winning Emmy and Golden Globe nominations for The Kominsky Method in 2019 and 20. All told, he performed in more than 100 movies, and while plenty were commercial duds, he bristled at Hollywood's obsession with measuring actors by their box office intake. "To treat us like horses, who's in first or second, is insanity," he said in 2012. "I wanted to move people." There's a business column on the opposite page. Threads. Meta's Twitter clone gains a foothold. Twitter's constant crises have now put it at imminent risk of losing its status as the water cooler of the internet, said Dave Lee in Bloomberg. Meta last week took direct aim at Twitter with its Threads app, gaining 100 million users within days of launch. The eye-opening debut was a masterclass in launching a new app. Anyone on Instagram could easily migrate their information onto Threads, which instantly populated feeds with accounts users already knew, and others they would perhaps like to, leapfrogging the cold start problem that has tripped up other clones that have tried to find an opening in the chaos that has engulfed Twitter since Elon Musk bought it 7 months ago. And Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg seems to be relishing the sense that he's rescuing Twitter users from the Musk regime. Musk, meanwhile, is having a meltdown, said Eric Ubelacker in the Daily Beast. He filed a lawsuit accusing Meta of poaching ex-Twitter employees to create the CopyCap app. And making sure to add insult to litigation, he also called Zuckerberg a cuck, a derogatory term embraced by the right fringe, in a tweet. Zuckerberg saw his opportunity here because of how bad Musk is at running a social media site, said Charlie Wartzel in The Atlantic. Just last week, Musk decided to limit how many tweets people can view. Musk suggested that he wanted to prevent third parties from scraping user data from the site. But it was a baffling decision for a platform that depends on engaging viewers. Unfortunately, it's nothing new for Musk, who has degraded the reliability of Twitter's service, filled the platform with bigots and spam, and alienated many of its power users. The new app functions almost exactly like Twitter, said Sarah Fisher in Axios. It's not the first time Meta has cloned and conquered a successful product, like its TikTok copycat Reels and its Snapchat copycat Stories, and regulators have noticed. The Federal Trade Commission is already pursuing a case against Meta for buying and cloning rivals to box them out. Zuckerberg is pitching Threads as a friendlier alternative to Twitter, but it raises many of the same concerns about moderation, said Katie Paul in Reuters. Within hours of launch, Threads accounts were posting about the Illuminati of billionaire Satanists, while other users compared each other to Nazis, and battled over everything from gender identity to violence in the West Bank. I wish Threads were a throwback to old Twitter, but it isn't, said Kyle Chayka in The New Yorker. What once made Twitter great was its commitment to real-time information, but its usefulness for breaking news has decayed under Musk, who has driven away news gatherers and news makers in favor of trolls and fabricators. For Threads or any social media app to have a chance to kill Twitter, said Molly Roberts in the Washington Post, people must let go of Twitter. For people to let go of Twitter, Twitter truly has to die. The good news for Meta is that Musk seems to be well on his way to killing his own company. And we'll flip over and finish out on the Talking Points page. Start with an article titled, Whitmer, a better candidate than Biden? Polls show wide unease among Democrats about having an octogenarian atop their 2024 ticket. President Biden's approval numbers are mired in the low 40s, and there's little enthusiasm among voters of either party for a Biden-Trump rematch. So why doesn't Gretchen Whitmer just run for president, said Mark Leibovich in The Atlantic. She's a popular governor who last year crushed a Republican challenger by 11 points in the purple state of Michigan, while flipping the legislature into full Democratic control for the first time in 40 years. She offers a pragmatic liberalism and a Midwestern personality that appeals to centrist and independents. Despite many Democratic colleagues and donors encouraging her to run, Whitmer vows she won't challenge Biden. But if a crank like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. can poll as high as 20%, clearly many Democrats are open to, even desperate for, a Biden alternative. She could be it. Whitmer is the real deal, said former Hillary Clinton campaign communications director Jennifer Palmieri in Vanity Fair. She's a shrewd operator who gets things done while connecting with voters who praise her authenticity. Based on my 3 decades in the political trenches, I'd say she has the talent, drive, and toughness to be the first female president. Even as she rules out a 2024 run, Whitmer is moving to boost her national profile, said Caroline Curran and Laura Gersoni in ABCNews.com. She's one of the 3 Democratic governors, alongside Gavin Newsom of California and J.B. Pritzker of Illinois, who've launched political action committees that can expand their influence and help them chart paths to the White House. Biden is unlikely to face a serious challenger for renomination, said Jeffrey Skelly in 538.com. Polls show Democrats mostly approve of Biden's performance as president, even though about half think the 80-year-old is too old to serve another term. For now, Biden's renomination seems assured. That could change, said Oliver Wiseman in thespectator.com. It's not hard to imagine possible trigger events that could force the octogenarian president to withdraw or prompt a real challenger to step up. Consider last month when Biden tripped on stage at the U.S. Air Force Academy graduation. When the resulting clip went viral, nervous Democrats could only glance at their calendars and contemplate the year and a half until Election Day. And we'll read some of the short notes. Nearly half of U.S. tap water contains forever chemicals, synthetic substances linked to ailments including cancer, thyroid disease, liver damage, and developmental delays. The U.S. Geological Survey found that 45% of both public and private well water has traces of the compounds used in products including cleaning supplies, packaging, carpets, and clothing. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has repeatedly used executive orders and legal exemptions passed by the Republican-controlled legislature to override Florida's sunshine laws and keep information from the public. The material he's kept private include his travel records, who pays for trips, visitor logs to the governor's mansion, and data on state COVID infections. Cars killed about 46,270 Americans last year, according to the National Safety Council, up from 39,107 in 2019. Car deaths spiked early in the pandemic as motorists on less trafficked roads drove faster and more recklessly, but have continued to rise and were 9% higher last year than in 2020. By the end of 2022, 77.5% of Americans over 16 had contracted COVID at least once, according to a new analysis by the CDC. By the end of 2022, 96.7% of Americans had antibodies from COVID infections, vaccinations, or both. And we'll finish with a quote from Maya Angelou, who says, "You can't use up creativity. The more you use, the more you have." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.